Really happy to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here as we turn our attention to the recovery of gray wolves in our Great Lakes region of the U.S. Adrian Whiteven, one of our guests today, DNR wolf specialist from Park Falls. He's been on our program a number of times. Adrian, welcome.
Morning, Larry. Morning, Jim and Tim.
Thanks very much for being with us today. And that Tim that Adrian was referring to is Tim Van Dielen, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. And Adrian and Tim are two of the three editors of the new book. It's called Recovery of Gray Wolves in the Great Lakes Region of the United States, an Endangered Species Success Story. It's published by Springer. Really happy to have them along. Ed Heskey of the Illinois Natural History Survey in Champaign, Illinois, was the third editor of that book. And it documents and evaluates the recovery of gray wolves in the Great Lakes region of the U.S. Adrian, to turn to you first, what was your goal in writing and editing this book?
Well, with wolf delisting coming around the corner back in the mid-late 2005-2004 period, we organized a symposium at our the Wildlife Society meeting to try to gather as much information on the recovery of wolves in the area and all the things we'd learned about them. And we thought that with this recovery and delisting occurring, a species being removed from the endangered species list, it was a good opportunity to try to get together as much of the information as we had learned about wolves during that recovery effort, from becoming listed as an endangered species in the early 1970s to the point to where they're no longer in need of being listed. And we wanted to gather as much of the materials and the things that we learned about wolves in that process of that population recovering.
And Tim Van Dielen.
Hi, Larry.
Great to have you with us as well. You started, you've got a good history of work here in Wisconsin with deer and so forth. Now you've been concentrating on wolves for the past several years.
That's correct. I've started out as a deer specialist for the Wisconsin DNR, and in 2005 I started as an assistant professor at the university.
And what about your goals for writing this book?
Well, Adrian approached me to help edit the book and also to recruit some authors to round out the number of chapters that we thought we needed to be complete. And Adrian put together a book proposal, and we sent it off, and the comment we got back is that Whiteven and Van Dielen collectively don't have a lot of editing experience. So I had a friend, a former colleague at the Illinois Natural History Survey, Ed Heskey. He had been associate editor for the journal Ecology and was at the time and currently is the managing editor for the journal Mammalogy. So he brought the editorial expertise to the table.
And the result is a very complete book on this recovery and well documented. Well, Adrian, as you kind of put this together, was there anything, a major surprise for you or something you didn't already know as you were looking, collecting this material?
Can't say there are any major surprises. I guess just the whole process of editing and putting something like this together is quite an ordeal, and just getting all that information together and seeing it all in one place was really a pleasure to be able to see and to get it all this information in a format that we can make it readily available and easy to access.
You know, we have some callers online, Don in Warren, Illinois. We'll get to you, Don, in just a minute. But you can join in, too, with a question or comment. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. When it comes to wolves, the Great Lakes region is kind of unique in some ways, as you point out in your book, Tim.
Correct. It's unique simply in the fact that wolves have recovered the way they've done, but also we have a very different ecology than other places in North America that have wolves. In the United States, wolves are currently recovering also in the Northern Rockies, and of course in Alaska there are healthy populations of wolves. And the prey bases, the amount of ungulate biomass available to the wolves, and even the competing predators make our situation in the Great Lakes state sort of unique.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's go to Don in Warren, Illinois. Don, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I've been waiting for this program for some time. My sister and my mother-in-law both remember probably 1925, 26, in northwestern Illinois and hearing the wolves, the wild wolves, howl. I have a picture I'm looking at right now of a wolf my grandfather dug out of a den, probably World War One. We can't. There's nobody alive that remembers that far back. But compared to the wolf in Dances with Wolves, this looks like a coyote. Has a very long, slim nose, comparatively short legs, small feet. Were there lots of subspecies? These people weren't confused with coyotes because I don't think they were even in within hundreds of miles in those days. Were there all kinds of subspecies that were like the timbers and northern and the plains and all that?
All right. Well, that's maybe both of our. Tim, you want to start with a?
Yeah, I used to work for the Illinois Natural History Survey, and when I worked there, I got the field notes from an ecologist who was working in the 20s and 30s, and he had saved a bunch of newspaper clippings. And it was quite common back then that people would try to eliminate the predators, and one of the ways they did that would be to surround a square section of land and drive to the middle and then kill the foxes and what they called brush wolves. And it was pretty common back then to call what we would identify today as a coyote, they called it a brush wolf.
Oh, okay.
And so it's quite likely what your family member had actually killed was a coyote. But at the same point, I have to say that we've recently had wolves dispersing out of the Northwoods and showing up in Illinois and in Missouri. So if there were wolves in Wisconsin in the 20s, it's not impossible that a wolf made it into Illinois and then got killed or pulled from a den or something like that.
No. And Adrian, what is kind of the history of wolves, back then or even before? We have a lot of wolves at one point in the state?
Well, probably when the first European settlers entered Wisconsin in the early 1800s, we probably had somewhere in the range of 3,000 to 5,000 wolves in the state. And we probably were still in the thousands of animals in the, up until the late 1800s. But throughout the 1900s, the population plummeted due to bounty systems, people being paid to kill wolves. So by about 1955, 1960, they became extinct in the state. And so we had a period of about 15 years where wolves were completely extirpated. And then starting in the mid-1970s with the Protection of the Endangered Species Act, they started slowly coming back. I'm pretty sure Southern Illinois would not have had any wolves at that time period, except possibly a disperser coming through from northern Wisconsin. So I'm guessing probably what those animals were probably the coyotes or brush wolves.
Yeah, as they were called. Okay, thanks, Don, for calling. Appreciate it. Mark in Douglas County, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
Good. I'd like a question for Adrian, I guess. I'm a farmer in Douglas County, a beef farmer, and within 4 miles of my house, if you drew a circle, in the last 2 years, the government has had to kill 16 wolves and disposed of them for preying on cattle in our area of Douglas County. The worst part is we still have as many wolves, I would say, bothering the cattle as we did before they killed the 16 wolves. So we're in kind of a high population of predatory wolves who are attacking cattle. And my question to Adrian is, and I guess I've been raising this because I participated in the early public hearings that took place up here in Superior to try to make sure that the government and the DNR had a plan, an end plan here. What are they going to do with these wolves that are causing all this problems? And to say that they're compensating the farmers adequately is not a true statement. And nobody raises cattle to feed the wolves. We have other things that we do with those cattle, and the government isn't our end game on this.
All right. Well, Adrian, we'll turn to you.
Well, Mark does point out an important problem that we do have as the population gets much higher, and we do document that in this book is the levels of depredation that have also increased with that increased population. And one of the solutions is to have more control on the wolf population to try to remove the problem animals through government trappers, through landowner permits. In the future, possibly some kind of a public trapping hunting season might be a consideration. But one of our frustrations that we've had is that we've not been able to keep wolves off the endangered species list. Despite the population recovery, we still have been dealing with lawsuits. And although wolves were delisted in 2007, they were again placed on the list in in 2008. They were delisted a couple of months ago and relisted again last week. So that's been a major frustration for us with the DNR to get better control on the wolf population. And there are places such as the South Range area where this farmer is that is probably not very well suited for wolves. And if wolves are going to be in, on that landscape, they are going to cause problems. We're hoping that we can get wolves completely off the endangered species list in the future and have more control on wolf numbers in those kind of places where they're causing problems.
So when the wolves are on that list, there's no way that, say, you could eliminate a problem wolf?
That's right. Unless we get a special permit from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for our government trappers, and that's usually a several-month process, and we've started that process currently, but right at this time, we don't have the authority to remove the problem wolves from this farm or any other farm.
So a landowner does not have that right either. So if you come out, I don't know, you'll look out the door and the wolf is eating one of your cows or cattle or maybe your the family dog, you don't have you have to let them do that?
You don't have a right to shoot the wolf. I mean, there are other things that can be done. You can shoot a gun in the air. You can make noises. You can try to harass the animal, scare the animal, and that often works. Once wolves see people, hear their sounds, will run back into the forest. So there are things that will work, but right now people can't use lethal force.
All right. Thanks for calling, Mark. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, with your questions or comments as we talk with two editors of the book Recovery of Gray Wolves in the Great Lakes region of the United States, Adrian Weideven of the Department of Natural Resources, Tim Van Dielen, assistant professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Really pleased to have them with us today. Well, when it comes to the factors which have allowed the Great Lakes region, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, to see this recovery, what have been the kind of the major factors in the recovery of the gray wolves? And Tim, I'll turn to you first, and then we'll go to Adrian.
Well, it's hard to say, I guess, and I think scientists would differ on what has been the major factors. I think the candidates would be our very high deer population, for one. Another would be the legal protection of the Endangered Species Act, but more importantly, the fact that there was pretty good compliance of it over time. We also have fairly large chunks of remote wooded habitat in the northern Great Lakes region. So if I had to shortlist my three biggest factors, I probably would choose those.
Okay. Adrian, would you agree with that? Or
I would, and I guess one an additional factor is that a relatively healthy population persisted in northern Minnesota, although it did get down to very low levels. That population persisted and was adjacent to a larger population in Canada, and once that population was given adequate protection, wolves from that area were able to spread out across the rest of the Great Lakes region.
A listener wonders, emailed in, if a wolf season idea has been squelched. It was apparently on the question list for the last Conservation Congress. Adrian, do you know?
Right now, there's no specific proposal for a wolf season. What we've been asked to do by our Natural Resource Board is to start developing the framework of what a public harvest would look like and how that would be conducted if we hold one in the future. But right now, the DNR doesn't have statutory authority from our legislature to conduct a public harvest. So there has not been a specific proposal for a public harvest. That's one of the things we're considering as we're updating our wolf management plan. And as long as they remain a federally listed species, either endangered or threatened, that's totally outside the range of possibility. So we have to first get wolves completely delisted, and then we have to get legislative authority before we could even consider a public harvest.
Adrian Weideven and Tim Van Dielen, authors of Recovery of Gray Wolves in the Great Lakes region of the United States, our guests here. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can join in with your questions as we talk gray wolves with Adrian Wideven and Tim Van Dielen. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. As you put your book together and researched this and collected the articles and so forth, I'm sure you came to some pretty good understandings about a number of things relating to wolf biology and ecology, endangered species management, landscape ecology, things of that nature. Let's talk about biology and ecology for a minute, and Tim, we'll start with you. What have we learned about wolf biology and ecology that's striking?
Well, I think in broad strokes, the experience in the Great Lakes states teaches us that wolves are not animals of big tractless wilderness areas, that given legal protection from illegal killing by humans, wolves seem to do fairly well in landscapes like northern Wisconsin, northern Michigan, and northern Minnesota, where there is a human presence, where you do have farming and other human activities that change the natural landscape. But the critical feature is that there has to be, in our case, compliance with the endangered species law that prevented excess or illegal killing. Prior to the experience in the Great Lakes, it was believed that in order to have large predators like wolves, you really needed big wilderness areas like you have in the western states and in Canada.
Adrian, comment?
I think that is one of the unique features and interesting things. And if we think about Wisconsin, we've got a state of over 5.5 million people, over 600,000 hunters. We've got more deer hunters than Wyoming has people living in it. And yet places like Wyoming have less of a wolf population than we're able to have. So the idea you need large wilderness tracts is certainly one of the things we found out is not necessary as long as wolves are given high levels of protection. I think the other thing we've also found out is that we're also one of the places that has some of the highest deer populations in the country, and despite having wolf populations, and that we can have healthy deer populations with lots of hunting opportunity along with having a healthy wolf population, that the presence of a wolf population doesn't eliminate the possibility of also having plenty of hunting opportunities.
Yeah. As an aside here, wondering about a state like Pennsylvania that has a pretty big deer population as well. I don't know what their wolf, if they have any wolves in the state, but in that particular state.
Well, they don't have a population. They would have, if anything, an occasional disperser coming in from Canada. But my guess is that some of the big deer states, Pennsylvania, New York, and possibly northern New England could probably sustain a wolf population as well. And one of the hopes for the book was that our experience would be able to inform conservation efforts for wolves in areas like that because they tend to be more similar than western ecosystems.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, Randy in Laval, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I've got a question. Having grown up from small child on a farm, these animals interplaying with farm animals, or experience with them all my life. Question: Does the wolf population at all follow the fox population? Is there any interplay between the fox population and the wolf population?
Oh, that's an interesting question too. Tim, you want to
say? Yeah, there probably is, Randy. There's a scientific theory out there that's called mesopredator release. And the way this would work in the wolf story is that without wolves, the coyotes depress the fox population because coyotes and foxes have an antagonistic relationship. But when you bring in wolves, you have an antagonistic relationship between the wolves and the coyotes, and the wolves tend to win in a head-to-head competition. So the wolves come in, the coyote populations decline, and that releases the smaller predators like foxes. So there's probably something to that.
Ah, interesting.
Because I remember, I don't know if this is a story, if all counties did this, but prior to 1960, I remember in our county, if a farmer killed a wolf, he cut the ears off and took the ears to the county courthouse and then was paid $25. Do you remember that?
Well, let's say, Adrian, do you remember that?
Well, I don't remember it, but I do know that we did pay bounties such as that on coyotes and foxes and wolves throughout the state prior to the 1960s. In many places, there was a state-sponsored bounty program on wolves that ended in 1957, but individual counties did also pay for foxes and coyotes. There wasn't a county program for wolves, but for foxes and coyotes. So, yeah, that was pretty much a deal. You brought the ears or some part of the animal over to the courthouse to get paid for the animal.
Thanks, Randy. I want to give Mike in Bayfield a chance to join in here. Mike, hi. Yes. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, my question is really quite simple. Given the amount of conflict, and I live up here in northern Wisconsin, northern Bayfield County, and given the degree of conflict between people who use the woods and the wolves in the woods, why do we even need wolves in the woods? I'll just listen on the air.
All right. Thanks, Mike, for calling. Adrian, I'm going to turn to you for that first.
Well, wolves serve a lot of ecological benefits, and most of us who live in the forest enjoy opportunity to also encounter sign of wolves. But if we think in terms of the white-tailed deer herd and the ecosystem they live in, except for a few years, except for perhaps the last 100 years or so, they've always lived with wolves. Wolves have been always part of the ecosystem of white-tailed deer, and that's kind of honed them to the animal that we especially like to see in the forest. And so wolves have impact on deer populations, prevent over-browsing, over-grazing by deer, spread them out on the landscape, have a beneficial effect as far as reducing disease spread through the deer population. They have some impacts on beaver population, which when they become too abundant can cause losses of valuable wetlands, flooding roads, and flooding valuable timber, or reducing trout habitat. So wolves as an apex predator have a lot of impacts on the overall ecosystem that provides benefits throughout the ecosystem as far as providing more biodiversity and just having a healthier forest environment.
Yeah. Tim, anything to add to that?
Well, Adrian covered some of the scientific reasons, and certainly there are philosophical reasons. The fact that both the state of Wisconsin and the federal government have robust endangered species law is evidence that society places some value on recovering endangered species, including wolves. And as public servants, the Wisconsin DNR, they're bound by those laws. And so it's almost a situation where the larger society is saying, this is something that we want to be a part of our Northwoods.
Good points. Thank you, Mike, for calling. Kevin in Oshkosh, it's on to you now. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I just want to say that it isn't the northern woods we're fighting the wolves in. I do a lot of hunting in the Shiocton area, which is Outagamie County, which is probably 5 minutes from Appleton, 10 minutes from Appleton. And I've encountered wolves numerous times this past year. And people was joking until the snow came and you could start finding the tracks, and we had a pack living in the area. One occasion I was out with my dog, and a female wolf came out with two other different wolves, smaller wolves, and my dog was going up to the wolves. I have no recourse. It could have killed my dog. This is Outagamie County. This, you know, that they're coming into our area now that's no longer northern Wisconsin. It's in the city, in the urban areas. And so as far as us saying endangered, I don't think we have an idea of what the population count is. I called even the DNR and reported that. Oh, they're not in this area. And all of a sudden we started seeing them and other people started reporting them. So I think that they're a little misinformation on the do-gooders' part as to what the wolf actually provides to the area.
All right, well, let's get Adrian Weidevin on to respond. Adrian?
Sure. It could be a combination of things. We do know we've had dispersing wolves that have traveled throughout the state of Wisconsin, and we've had several animals in the Outagamie, Wapaka County area. They seem to especially follow that Wolf River system through there, so it's certainly possible Kevin could be encountering wolves that are passing through the area. We've not detected any actual pack activity in that area. That's not to say it's impossible, but it's nothing that we've been able to find or verify. The other possibility is that we do frequently have times when wolf-dog hybrids get out in the wild. And these animals will look very wolf-like in appearance, but they usually lack fear of people, and they can be aggressive, and there can be encounters with those. And the DNR is developing regulations to control wolf-dog hybrids, and that'll be coming up this fall. We'll have several public meetings on developing some regulations, so the state will have more authority to control the release of these animals into the wild. But it does point out the need to have more control on the wolf population, which is something we hope to get once wolves are completely delisted.
How do you go about the business of determining the number of wolves or the populations, Adrian?
Most of our surveys are based on a combination of radio telemetry, trapping wolves in the spring and summer, and then following their movements with airplanes year-round with DNR pilots, and doing winter track surveys in forested areas of northern Wisconsin, following forest roads after fresh snowfalls and searching for tracks. But we also rely heavily on reports from the general public, such as people like Kevin reporting observations, and we try to follow up on those observations and try to determine whether these animals are really wolves or some other animals are being seen. But it's a combination of those radio telemetry surveys, snow track surveys, and reports from the public. Probably our weakest area is that when wolves move out of the large forested areas, it does become more difficult to track them and to survey them. And so we are relying more on public reports once we get into the more agricultural areas.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Kevin. Bill in Ozaukee County, we turn to you again. Bill, hello.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, I'll make it quick. 3 points. One, with healthy populations of wolves in Yellowstone and in Canada and in Alaska, why in heaven's name do we need to have them in Wisconsin? And I do not accept the explanation the gentleman gave earlier. Given the relative size of our deer herd and the small wolf population, that there really is a population control factor coming from the wolf population. Secondly, how are you going to justify wolves as soon as one, and how soon will it be that a wolf takes a child from a campground and kills it and eats it? And third, what are you going to introduce next, the grizzly bear?
Okay. Well, I'm going to turn to Adrian to begin, and then we'll let Tim join in as well.
I think the last point is one I'd especially want to focus on, is what we're going to introduce, and that's one of the unique features about wolf recovery in the Great Lakes region. It was not based on any reintroductions. The wolves in the Great Lakes region spread out by themselves. So what we have out here is a natural population. It's not a reintroduced population, unlike Yellowstone or central Idaho. These are wolves that return on the landscape on their own. As far as, why do we need wolves in Wisconsin? They have benefits to the ecosystem, as we talked about earlier. People expect us to take care of endangered species, and native species have a right to exist on the landscapes where there's suitable habitat for them. As far as the chance of a child attack, there's a remote possibility with any of our large carnivores, with bears or wolves or coyotes, that those things could occur. But the chances of those things are relatively rare, and we do everything we can to try to manage the population to try to discourage those kind of things. Eliminating wolves would not eliminate the possibility some other animal could do the same thing. So it's not that wolves alone are going to cause those kind of problems.
Tim, a comment from you.
Well, the only thing I would add is that we are starting to see signals that suggest that wolves are giving us local pockets of lower deer population, and even that within those pockets of lower deer density, we're seeing a response on behalf of some of the browse-sensitive plants. That's research that's currently going on right now, but the reports back suggest that there is a beneficial top-down effect of having wolves in the area.
We had an email from Christine who asks how many packs of wolves are in Wisconsin and what are the numbers we're looking for to get them off the list or get them delisted.
Well, our most current count this last winter, we counted 626 to 662 wolves in Wisconsin in 162 different packs. So That's our population last winter before the pups were born this spring. The actual numbers to get them off the federal endangered species list was to have a population of at least 100 wolves between Wisconsin and Michigan, while there were also a population of 1,250 to 1,400 in Minnesota. So we're about 12 times as high as the minimum requirements for federally delisting for Wisconsin and Michigan. And Minnesota is at a population of about 3,000, so they're about 2.5 times as high as the federal requirements. So we're way above the minimum levels that were set by the federal recovery plan for delisting wolves in our area.
And Joe and Madison wonders, shouldn't we be restoring the eastern wolf or the northern red wolf instead of the gray wolf to the majority of the Great Lakes region? Weren't they likely also present originally, and wouldn't they be more able to live off the prey base, deer, with fewer depredations of larger animals like cattle? Adrian?
That gets into an interesting taxonomical question, and the chapter by Ron Nowak goes into a lot of details of that. We're not bringing in any specific wolf. We're letting whatever wolf feels they can inhabit the area return to the area. And what we've found through genetic analysis is that our wolves are mostly gray wolves, but they do have some eastern wolf in them. So Jill is correct, and that's probably the most appropriate wolf for our area, but that's the wolf that's naturally spreading into the landscape on its own. So we don't have to do anything specific to try to bring that wolf back. It's coming back on its own.
And Rebecca wonders about control. She says, my question involves controlling the wolf population via hunts. I'm wondering if there are ways in which we can learn better to live with them instead of immediately trying to hunt them. Are there things farmers can do to limit livestock exposure to the wolves? Seems to me that we're rushing to delist them. And Adrian, I'll start with you.
Yes, the purpose of a harvest would be to manage the population, wouldn't necessarily be to try to eliminate the wolf population, but there are things that farmers do, and every time there's any depredations, whether perceived depredation by wolves, where wolves actually cause a depredation, or whether a farmer has lost livestock to some other animal where they thought an issue was wolf, they get people from USDA Wildlife Services that come to their property and give them advice on how to reduce their risk of wolf attacks. So we're constantly doing education on ways to reduce attacks of wolves, telling farmers about cleaning up carcasses and providing scare devices through wildlife services and special flagging around farm areas. But none of these non-lethal methods are foolproof, and wolves do occasionally learn to get by those. And we do find that if we get into landscapes where there's a lot of farms and there are wolves living on those kind of landscapes, it's just a matter of time before it seems like wolves will start depredating on farms. So there are places that are just really not suitable for wolves. In heavily forested areas, there's plenty of places where wolves can live, and they provide a lot of benefits to the ecosystem. But in highly agricultural areas, wolves are probably not going to be real suitable.
Yeah. Tim, any comment?
Well, ultimately, delisting the wolves, in this case, I think benefits the wolf population in a larger sense, because public acceptance depends on control of depredation problems that's effective and efficient and quick. And right now, the manager's hands are in a certain sense tied, despite the fact that we have a healthy, robust wolf population that is really in no danger of extinction. But there's also an opportunity cost here. The effort and money that are going into management of wolves as an endangered species are coming out of a limited pot that could be better directed at species that are truly endangered.
Yeah. Sandy in Neshota, we'll go to you. Sandy, hello. Sandy, are you there? Oh, maybe we lost Sandy. Let's go to Doug in Waukesha then next. Doug, hello to you.
Hi. As a caller alluded to earlier, there seems to be the misinterpretation out there that the DNR actually stocked wolves in Wisconsin. But I think that might be somewhat confused with some of the relocation efforts that have been done. My question is, when problem wolves are encountered, when and how is a decision made between euthanizing the wolves or actually relocating them?
All right. Adrian?
Well, through 2002, we had no authority in Wisconsin to do any euthanizing of wolves, so all wolves were translocated that were causing problems at that point. Since then, most wolves that have caused depredation problems have been euthanized if we've had authority, either because wolves were downlisted or threatened or delisted completely, or we had a special permit from the Fish and Wildlife Service. But if none of those exist, then we have no authority, and then we have no choice but to move wolves. In part, right now, the landscape is pretty well covered with wolves, and there really aren't places to take them anymore. And when you've got an animal that's already habituated to killing livestock, to killing domestic animals, moving it from one place to another place probably is just spreading the problem to another area. And that probably infuriates people even more if they know that the animal that's causing their problems was one that was released by the DNR versus one that just got there on their own. So yeah. In most cases where wolves start killing domestic animals, and if we have authority to remove, to euthanize the wolf, that's what we would do.
What happens to the wolf that is euthanized? I mean, it's dead, of course, but is it studied? Is it what's done to the wolf itself?
Yes, we get a lot of use out of those. The skulls and hides are used for educational purposes. Some of the animals have been used in research. Some of them are being used for testing, examining the effects of different types of trapping. Tim had a student who did some studies on fatty acid contents of the animals as far as predicting food habits. So we're trying to make as much use of those carcasses as possible. A lot of them are on in the Museum of the Zoology Collection down in Madison. So we try to make as much use out of those animals as we can.
And Tim, I want to go back to you as here as we get nearer the end of the show. And one of the things I didn't do was to ask you to sort of go through and explain the chapters or what you've got in your book, Recovery of the Gray Wolves.
Well, the Recovery of the Gray Wolves was really an interdisciplinary effort. And so this is a very interdisciplinary book. It starts out with history, tracing wolf recovery in the Great Lakes back to luminaries like Aldo Leopold and Aldous Murray and some of those other folks. And then we have a section for the three individual states that describes the history, management, and plans. We have a few chapters on new research having to do with wolf habitat in Wisconsin and our understanding of that, and also the population growth rates of wolves south of Lake Superior. We have a chapter in there on education, a chapter in there on the human dimensions of having wolves, some of the specialized behaviors that are important, den site selection and dispersal. And then the three editors wrote a concluding chapter where we tried to project or predict or say something about what we learned collectively by putting the book together.
So it's a pretty comprehensive book, and I want to thank both of you for being with us today and talking about the book and about gray wolves. Adrian, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. Tim Van Dielen, thank you so much as well.
Thank you for having me.
I hope we can have these guys back. Maybe when we'll see what happens if the relisting turns into a delisting on the wolves and find out what happened and find out how things are going with that. Adrian Wedevin, Tim Van Dielen, Adrian, DNR Wolf Specialist out of Park Falls. Tim, Assistant Professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. And the title of their book is Recovery of Gray Wolves in the Great Lakes Region of the United States, an Endangered Species Success Story. It's published by Springer. So you might want to take a look at it. You know what? It rained a little bit, sprinkled a little bit here in Madison, and I was really happy to see it, although it interfered with my bike riding a little bit this morning. But I was mighty happy to see it because we haven't had a whole lot of rain here lately. And speaking of rain, we're going to talk about rain, droughts, flood, lake levels with Tim Asplund of the DNR in Madison and Madeline Gakowitz, who is a hydrologist with the Wisconsin Geologic and Natural History Survey. That's coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.